Welcome to the junior year episode 31 of the Horror Podclass. My name is Tyler, and I am the editor-in-chief here at Signal Horizon, a magazine dedicated to exploring horror both in and out of the classroom. When I'm not managing Signal Horizon, I'm a teacher at a local high school in Kansas City, Missouri, and tonight I am joined by our co-host, as I am every night here at the Horror Podclass, award-winning writer Oren Gray.
Hey man, how's it going?
I mean, I'm still stuck here and wearing masks, so, you know, it is what it is.
I left the house today, and I, like, went a quarter of a block before I realized that I had forgotten my mask and had to, like, come back and get it. But I was, like, really glad that I didn't go further. Like, I was glad I didn't get to the store.
Yeah,
and
right.
Not
and
it then, and be like, well, you know, yeah.
You gotta make the choice, you
well,
know?
And,
you gotta...
And, like, not every place is, it's a choice. Like, some places, they're required. And, I mean, I guess if I went in, they probably wouldn't kick me out. But, like, the sign says required, and I'd feel like a real jerk. But I want to wear it anyway. Like, it's the right thing to do, but...
Right, exactly. But you would feel like one of those MAGA assholes.
Right.
It's like, I refuse to let the government shackle me or
right.
whatever.
I'm going
like,
to wear my freedoms instead.
Yeah, right. Like, dude, it's not even that deep, man. Just like, don't give COVID to your neighbor.
Right.
That's all we're saying. You know, like, fucking vote for whoever you want. Just don't kill my elderly, you know, librarian.
Also, yeah. Also, don't vote for whoever you want. But
right, yeah.
But we'll get to that later.
Very true.
Let's start by not killing people. Then we'll get
right.
To,
baby steps,
right.
Oren. Baby
right.
steps. Okay, we're teaching empathy
one
here.
Thing at
so.
A time.
We don't want to throw him into the drown or into the deep end and let him drown. I mean, whatever. Yeah. So now would be a good point, starting off point to pivot to what we are watching and what we are excited about this week. Oren, what's going on at the Gray household? Have you seen anything or read anything cool?
So I've gotten really into 5th edition D&D. I think I may have mentioned this on a previous episode, which, of course, I got really into it, you know, during a pandemic when I can't play it.
You could do it on Zoom, right? I've seen some
yeah,
people do
like,
that
and
shit.
Yeah, and you have, like, they have, like, whole online, like, Roll20 and things. But, like, so the problem with doing things like this online is, like, it's too much like talking on the phone. And I hate talking
yeah.
on the phone. Like, it's a miracle that you've got me on a podcast, honestly. Like, I hate talking on the phone. And so, like...
But this is a step up.
Right?
It's a step
it,
in
it
the
is,
right direction, at
you
least,
know,
right?
It's good. But, like, so I just haven't tried it. I haven't tried the, like, Zoom thing really yet. But, I mean, so I've done a little bit with a different game that's a little bit less, modular, I guess, in D&D, but I've not done much with it. But anyway, so I got really into that. So I've been really reading that stuff. I did watch this, I watched Dogura, which is it's a kaiju movie from 1964. It's directed by Ishiro Honda, the guy directed Godzilla and pretty much all the famous kaiju movies.
Right.
And it was really weird. Like, it's kind of boring, but it was really strange because it's, like, basically, I'm pretty sure he went to Toho and he was like, hey, I want to make a caper movie about a bunch of diamond thieves. And they were like, well, it's 1964, you're going to have to put a kaiju in there. And he's like, all right, 5 minutes of one. Does that sound good? And they were like, yeah, sounds great. And so there's, like, 5 minutes of this weird, incredibly weird kaiju that's, like, a big translucent jellyfish that floats in the sky.
All right.
But it's, like, it's barely in the movie, and, like, the entire rest of the movie is, like, about this diamond caper.
I like that. I mean, I'm a big fan of caper movies generally, so does the kaiju act as, like, a foil to all of that?
Sort of. So, like, it eats carbon, I think. So, like, it also steals some diamonds in that it eats them. And
okay.
it confuses the whole caper. Like, the police are trying to catch the thieves, but there's also these diamonds that have gone missing that turn out to have been eaten by the kaiju. And
Sure.
You know,
all right.
So
it's like a dilithium crystal or something.
Yeah.
It has to eat them to stay functioning.
Or something.
Well,
it's a little... So the version that was on Prime was dubbed, which didn't help. But, like, the storyline doesn't make a ton of sense. maybe
Fair
maybe
enough.
Maybe in closer translation it would. I don't know.
So the giant jellyfish in the sky reminds me of a book that came out last year, maybe 2 years ago, called The Writhing Skies.
I've heard good stuff about that one.
By Betty Rocksteady. It's super fun and gory as shit. And yeah, like it is everything you expect out of a horror movie. Yeah. So, all right. So you watched it. Tell us the title again.
Dogora? Dogora. It's on Prime.
And it's available on Prime. Very good. Very good. Anything else?
That's about it, Lele.
Very good. Well, by the time this episode comes out, Twilight Zone Season 2 will be out, and that's what I've been checking out. If it's not out already, there will be an interview that I have with Tananarive Due that's going to come later on, because she directs one of these episodes. And I was relatively outspoken about my lack of joy for Season 1. It seemed like it didn't really have its own tone, and the general direction of the first season seemed really lost and not in a fun way. And I am here to tell you that from what I have seen, I've seen 4 episodes now of season 2, and they're fantastic. They lean into this kind of it's kind of like a dark morality play, and they're a lot like some early versions of Tales from the Crypt, where like the bad guy always gets it in the worst way possible, you know, like, and that makes them all really fun. Like they have their own ideas and concept and direction for sure, but they are much more edgy, and I mean that in a great way. So they're a ton of fun. I can highly recommend, if the other episodes are like the 4 that I've seen, you should check out Twilight Zone Season 2.
How many episodes are there in a season of Twilight Zone, the new one?
I think there are 8. Okay, I think there are 8
like,
total.
I was thinking it was one of the ones that was like shorter.
Yeah. And that, like, if you haven't seen the first season, maybe you want to jump forward a couple of minutes, because I'm going to spoil the end of Season 1. Season 1, it's like, there is this like character that can only see like a blurry character, like in a movie or in a like a photograph, and it's like this like kind of ghost that haunts her, you know?
Okay.
And I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then you get to the end, and it's like a movie within a movie, right? Like it uses that kind of motif. Uh-huh. And in the end, the blurry figure ends up being like Rod Serling, and it's like a meta Twilight Zone within a Twilight Zone. And it's like, it's as my 13-year-old son would say, it's a tryhard, you know, like it's just too much. And there's none of that in this season. It's all like, they're not trying to nod to anything other than just having fun with the kind of cool campy stories that they have. So yeah, man, like it's good, I think.
Cool.
The other thing, I'm started reading Clown in the Cornfield by Adam Cesar. I'm saying that right. Yeah. It's a ton of fun, and it's like a YA novel. So I am a sucker for good, scary, like young adult horror fiction, because sometimes it's just really like it's either too soft, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's kind of I think what they do is when something is not very good, they slap the YA title on it, you know, and they're like, kids will read anything. This is fantastic. It's a ton of fun. It treats its audience as an adult, but it's written in such a way that like the Lexile reading level isn't super duper high. And like, I don't know, as soon as I'm done with it, I'm going to give it to the oldest and let him take a look at it, because I think it is really good.
I am super excited to read it. Adam M is actually a good friend of mine and a great writer. And I've loved. I haven't read all of his stuff, but I've read like half of it, and I've loved everything I've read. I'm really looking forward to this. This is kind of his big, like, big five publisher breakout, you know, thing, and I'm really looking forward to that. Also, he just announced today, which is, I'm super excited both to get my hands on this book and also super excited for him. He wrote the bestiary for the Dark Crystal series.
Really?
So, yeah, so they're publishing, like, a fully illustrated, like, every creature in the series that's even, like, mentioned in the series is going to be in this, like...
Oh, how cool!
In this whole book. And he wrote the whole book and wrote all the words and everything, which is, like, the coolest thing. So I'm super fucking excited about that. Also, like,
well, very good.
Writing a bestiary is, like, my dream job, right?
It's
just a bunch of things about monsters, right? I don't have to worry about, like, a plot or something. I just describe a bunch of monsters. Yes, please.
Sign me up for that. All right, so Signal Horizon will be publishing Orin Gray's Bestiary of the Greater Weird or something at some point in time. So.
Just a bunch of monsters. That's what it's called.
Yeah. Just a bunch of... I'd read that.
I mean, I would absolutely. Like, if I was walking through a bookstore and saw a book called Just a Bunch of Monsters, I would pick it up. Like,
seconds.
Like, I wouldn't even have to think. There would just be, like, a synapse that fired without me knowing it, and I'd be holding it already.
Yeah, right. It would either have to be the raddest coffee table book, okay? Or I also see, like, 12 or 13-year-old Tyler seeing that coloring book or something.
Right.
And being like, oh, yes, you know, like, this is my shit. So, yeah, I don't know. We haven't decided what it'll be. It'll either be a coffee table book or a coloring book. You all decide. You should decide by letting us know what you think of those options at the Horror Podcast Study Group on Facebook. All you got to do is type in Horror Podcast Study Group, and you will take us directly there. Otherwise, feel free at any point in time. You can send me whatever derogatory emails that you would like to tyler@signalhorizon.com, and let us know what you think of the episodes. If we're talking about these episodes... Then mosey on over to iTunes, where you can rate and review us. Tell us if you liked an episode. Give us that 5-star review. That's how we get elevated. And, you know, we get more listeners. We get more folks in class. So we want those people here. So it's Dark Corners, and we are talking about just an incredibly badass movie tonight. And it carries with it, I think... very special and very important kind of ideas, and those ideas lend themselves really well to our Dark Corner of the Web tonight. Right now, because of the Black Lives Matter movement, which we 100% stand behind, as does Signal Horizon, there are a number of streaming channels and networks that have put a lot of fantastic African-American literature, African-American cinema up on their platforms for free. And Shudder, our good people over at Shudder, are no different. You can watch their documentary all about African-American horror movies, kind of the evolution of what those horror movies look like. It's called Horror Noir, and they put it in front of their paywall, so you can see it 100% for free.
That's awesome.
And I'm telling you, it is... It's incredible, man. It's just... It is... really a soft entry into a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I think when people hear documentaries, they're like, oh, shit, not a bunch of stuffy people talking. And they have all kinds of talking heads, and they are fantastic and experts in their field. And honestly, I think you would probably agree with me here, Oren, I'm a white dude, and as my wife would tell you, I like to hear myself talk a lot, but it's time for white dudes like me to shut up and listen to, you know, people of color tell their stories. 100%. And that's what Horror Noir does. So go check it out. It's on Shudder. It is 100% for free. And then if you like what they do, you should support them and buy yourself a membership. You can try it out for a free 30 days by using our promo code Signal, and that lets them know they got listeners that are trying to see what we're doing here on the podcast. Yeah. So, have you seen Horror Noir yet?
I actually haven't seen all of it yet. So,
okay,
but
it's good.
Yeah,
oh,
no,
man, it's so good.
It's one of those ones that I keep putting off because I know it's good. Like, I've watched a little bit.
Yeah,
and I watched a little bit of it, and I was like. A lot of times I'll watch documentaries and I'll watch them like while I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
And it was one where like I started doing that and I was like, no, I'm gonna need to sit down with this one. And so I've just been putting it off.
Yeah.
And I've been putting it off until like I was in the right space to like just sit down and watch the whole thing.
I think that is giving it the respect it deserves. And I might add, they had so much success, I think, with Horror Noir that they are producing a documentary all about queer horror.
Yeah.
And they've made a kind of a big deal about it since it's Pride Month. Mm-hmm. So yeah, man.
Is the Scream Queen documentary on Shudder as well? Do you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I know.
And I saw that at Fantastic Fest, and it is great too.
Yeah.
Because it is amazing to me, like, having just watched Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 with my son this summer, and then seeing that documentary, It was like, Jesus, this shit ruined, I've forgotten his name, the lead actor there. It just ruined that guy's life.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember, like, before the documentary came out, I remember reading, like, an interview with him or something where he finally, you know, talked about it, you know, all these years later, and it was when they were making the documentary, and it was just like, holy shit, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like, oh my God. But
it just hurt my heart because, I mean, I work with high school, and this, he was essentially a high school kid.
Right.
He wasn't much older than that, you know, and you see the director kind of pitching ideas at him or like, you should try this. And in retrospect, you understand either like blatantly or latently that director is trying to add this kind of homosexual subtext to it. And this kid doesn't know any better, you know, like he's just happy to be in a film.
Right.
And it just, yeah. Yeah. It's really sad and tragic, but the movie does a really good job of kind of tying up some of those loose ends.
Right.
And leaving you with a little bit of hope, which I think is important.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's an important story to have told right now too, just in the, you know, in the moment we're having, not right this second specifically, but like with Me Too and with just a time for these kind of stories to be heard that have been kind of a whisper network for so many years. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's just so much stuff in show business and in so many industries that everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people in the industry knew, but it wasn't like public. And
yeah,
now a lot
right.
of it's finally coming public, and like people are being protected more, hopefully. And you know, I think that's, you know, vital.
Yeah,
and especially
dude,
with
like,
stuff like what happened at Cinestate, you know, and
right, just, right.
Like, with all the stuff coming to light right now, I think it's really good that we're telling these stories and talking about this shit.
Yeah, and I think the job of the industry or people that love the industry or love genre film or whatever is to try to elevate those stories. And if there is anything positive to come out of the Cinestate conversation and the recent stuff that has come to light about the Saska sisters, it's that people are finally elevating those voices, and they've decided maybe access to those people or trying to ingratiate themselves to those people is not worth ruining people's lives.
Right.
And in that way, you know, fucking bravo.
Yeah,
dude.
Absolutely.
You know?
I haven't actually heard the thing about the Saska sisters, so we should talk about it later, but
yeah, I guess they suck. I mean, long story short, yeah, they suck. So,
you know, it's sad how many people who get to positions of power suck, but you know, hey. Like,
yeah, right.
But part of that is like, part of that is that we haven't been telling these stories. You know, we've been keeping it
yeah.
quiet. And part of it is that, you know, people who want power suck. Like,
yeah, right, right. And there is
a
certain...
If you
I
want
have...
to have power over another person, you're probably a bad person. Like,
yeah, yeah. I think that has been the kind of... You know, I'm always trying to juggle... This is a little off the rails, but I think it's probably an important conversation. Like, I'm always looking for ways to build the brand, right? And to advocate for horror in the classroom, and Signal Horizon has been a wonderful vehicle to do that. But like at some point you're like, dude, am I willing to do that thing? And it doesn't matter what that thing is. Mm-hmm. Like that thing is like dick over somebody or like try to scoop somebody and yeah, like whatever. And the bottom line is, like, there's too much joy in doing the things that I do to do that.
Right.
You know? And I which means, you know, we'll have our 13 subscribers to the horror podcast, and I'm going to be okay with that.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I totally am fine with that.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, like, it's so frustrating when you see people do horrible things to one another in any industry like this, because in any industry like this, the stakes are not very high. Like, we're not going to be billionaires from doing this,
right.
No matter how well we do. You know, we're never going to be that person. And so, why would you hurt another person for the tiny advantage it will give you?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
why would you do it ever? But right. Why would you do it for, right. for such a small thing, you know?
Yeah, man. Like, I understand that markets are cutthroat, and especially in journalism sometimes, that the illusion that you can get something out, you know, 5 minutes before somebody else can translate to, you know, actual dollars. But, like, I mean, we're talking $10, $20, $100 right. max, you know? Like, well, it's not like I scooped this guy and I was a total dick to him in the process and it made me $1 billion.
Right. And like, dragging this back to what we're going to be talking about tonight, it's similar to the conversation people have a lot when, like, the riots and things happen, where it's like, oh, you know, the rioters burned down up McDonald's or whatever. They've lost all my credibility with me. It's like, it's just a building. And yeah, it's
right,
people's
right.
livelihoods and it's money, and it is important that it's, like, buildings are important, but they're not nearly as important as lives.
Right.
And so, yeah. Like, you know, we're protesting murder, and you're upset about breaking windows. Like, these two things are not equal.
Right. And we should not pretend that they are, but
right.
I think it is often, especially for the people with the power, right, for
right.
the dominant folks, to make that false equivalency and to try to it is the safe space to retreat to so that you don't have to confront yourself and all this shit that you have done.
Right.
And that includes me, man.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the big conversation that my wife and I have, and this is like a very special episode of the Horror Podcast, by the way.
We're eventually going to talk about a movie, y'all.
And the movie's fucking rad, so just hang in there with us. Like, my wife and I are both teachers, and so this entire thing has led us to think about how we teach to students of color and how we need to teach differently, but also, like, what our role is in the larger movement, you know, which is part of the reason why we speak up as much as we do, because, I don't know, we got kids of color in our class that are, you know, that are surviving shit that's infinitely worse than anything that we'll see.
Oh, yeah.
So. And they survive it by turning to movies like Sugar Hill.
Here we go, finally.
Yep. All of that conversation leads us to tonight's essential question, which is Sugar Hill an example of blaxploitation?
Sugar is sweet. Revenge is sweeter.
I'm passing sentence.
Meet Sugar Hill.
No, please.
Not a place. But a brand new face.
My friends call me Sugar.
The foxiest.
Looking for anything special?
Sexiest. Deadliest chicken town. The mob took Sugar's man away. And now, she's gonna make them pay.
I want them dead.
With a voodoo priestess called Mama Matrace.
I know what you can do. The power you possess.
How strong is your hate?
And Baron Samedi, too.
My particular special. A drink that I'm famous for. The zombie.
This is my domain. A kingdom of the dead.
And an army of undead behind her.
Each death has had something to do with voodoo ritual.
There's nothing that Sugar can't do.
Use it.
The mob has never seen anything like Sugar Hill and her zombie hitmen.
All right. So, IMDb has a relatively brief summary that is relatively spoiler-free. those of you that have not seen Sugar Hill, go watch it right now. It's great. It's super but good. If you're not, then here's your summary. When her boyfriend is murdered by gangsters, Sugar Hill decides not to get mad, but bad. She entreats voodoo queen Mama Matrice to call on Baron Samadhi, Lord of the Dead, for help with a gruesome revenge. In exchange for Sugar's soul, the Dark Master raises up a zombie army to do her bidding. The bad guys, who think they got away, are about to find out that they are dead wrong. I think that summary is kind of charming.
That last line is spot on. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got a couple of facts wrong, which is weird for a summary, but...
Oh, yeah? What did they get wrong?
It's not in exchange for her soul. Like, she offers that, and he explicitly says he's not interested in souls.
Yeah, that's right.
For one thing.
Because that very end, you know, like, right. You would expect the very end of the film that, you know, he would claim what's hers, but it's, you know, a little more hopeful, a little more... Well, joyous. I don't know,
one of the things that I love about Sugar Hill, which there's a lot of things that I love about Sugar Hill, which we're going to get to, but we're going to jump right to the ending, apparently, is that in almost any other movie, like, Sugar Hill would be both the villain and the protagonist. Like, she would, you would watch her get her revenge, and you would cheer for her and everything, but at the end, she would die or something in order to redeem her bad actions, right?
Right, yeah, sure.
But her actions are never portrayed as bad.
No,
like, she
man.
100% gets away with it, and it's just, like, pure righteous victory.
Yeah, righteous is a wonderful word to describe her character and that kind of vindictive nature of things.
Right, and,
right?
Like, she's never... And the other thing you would normally get is, like, the last guy would turn the table somewhat to put her in some kind of jeopardy, which also never happens.
Like, yeah.
It's just pure
revenge.
Yeah, yeah, like...
Wonderful.
Yeah, like, yeah, and just, like, she is always on top. She is always in charge. She's never in danger. She's never reduced in any way. Which is just it's a great thing to see for any female character, and it's a really great thing to see for a, you know, a black female character, even now, let alone when the movie was made.
Right, yeah. I think, so, that is a great entree point to one of the first things I want to talk about. There is a great article from Grace D. Gibson that discusses, like, blaxploitation as... an example of strong female black characters. And one of the questions that she kind of posits in the article is, right now, are we poised for a renaissance of blaxploitation in that, like, it's time to give rise to strong black female characters again? Mm-hmm. And this particular subgenre is a great example of that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, no better character exists than Sugar freaking Hill, man. Like,
oh my God, she's so great.
Yeah, and she is strong. She doesn't need a man. In fact, you know, like, her man dies at the beginning of the film, you know?
Right.
So, like, I don't know. I think I maybe agree a little bit with Grace that... I remember reading an article, maybe I can track it down, that the single largest, like, part of the Democratic Party that is reliable, right, mm-hmm. that comes out and votes in mass, always at numbers that exceed the previous election, are black women,
are
African-American women. And, like that, I would argue, is certainly that particular demographic is one that we should listen to, as we've talked about, you know, earlier in the episode, but also one that's, like, driving political change as we speak.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's really impossible to talk about this film or that topic without also talking about Black Lives Matter and that kind of stuff. And we have just seen so many African-American female activists come out that, like, Yeah, dude. I think I'm on the same page as Grace, at least with that argument.
Yeah.
Marky Bay is the absolute shit.
Yeah.
Like, she's so great.
She's so good.
So.
And it is, like, so before I say what I was about to say, like, it's great, like, her character, like you said, she doesn't need a man to do things for her or anything. She, like, her sexuality is never used against her at all. She obviously had a sexual relationship with the detective previously, before moving on to the man who gets killed at the beginning, and, like, that's sure. never shown as anything but a positive thing.
Right, yeah.
Like, it's just, it is delightful how much she controls this movie.
And she does. This is unabashedly her movie.
Hey, Whitey! You and your punk friends killed my man!
You know, you got one of the prettiest asses in town. I'd sure hate to see it kicked in for accusing people.
I'm not accusing you, honk. I'm passing sentence.
You ain't reading me, are you?
And the sentence is death.
She is a full-on movie star that I think embraces that role, you know?
And what I was going to say is that it's a miracle that she manages to pull that off, because the guy who plays Baron Samedi is phenomenal.
Yeah, right.
And anytime, like, he doesn't just completely steal the movie out from under her, she must be doing an amazing job, because he is so great.
Yeah, he's big and, like, I don't know. Like, I know of that character.
Mm-hmm.
I have to stick some stuff in the show notes that we'll share with you all. You can check it out. About Baron Samedi as this, like, you know, kind of monster, right? As this
right.
voodoo god-like monster. But he is, like, big and campy and just eats the screen up.
Oh, my
so.
God. He's so good. And...
But that...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, this whole movie is full of those things, though, right? Baron Samedi is huge, right? What, Mrs. Matrice, right?
Right, Mother Matrice.
Mama Matrice, yeah. Is big and huge as a character,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
And every single zombie that you see is big and huge, you know? Like,
yeah.
They are not small side characters. They look great. They are fully realized. They're just so amazing from a creepy character
oh my God. And
perspective.
Like, I love, so maybe my favorite zombie design of all time is these zombies with their, like, ball-bearing eyes.
Yeah, right.
Which is so, and, like, the cobwebs and everything, it's so creepy.
Yeah. And they come up from the swamp, you
right.
know, so they have this kind of bayou-esque
right.
feel about it,
yeah.
you know?
And, like, oh, it's so good. But like, back to Baron Samedi, like, the actor playing him, one of the things that I find really fascinating is, like, the way he does the almost, he plays into the sort of subservient stereotype when he's interacting with the white characters. He puts on this kind of, like, yesa, nosa kind of play acting until he has them trapped, and they all trap themselves because they just assume it's true. They don't even look twice. Like, he doesn't look right at all. He's got, like, a big fucking bone, like, beak earring, and he's dressed all wrong for what he's doing and everything, but they don't look twice at him because he's playing a subservient, like, he's being subservient to them, and so they just trust him.
Yeah.
And then walk right into the trap, and, like, it's because they underestimate, you know, the black characters.
Oh, yeah. And I think that is what separates this film maybe from some other blaxploitation film, is, like, it's intentionally using some of those stereotypes to punish white characters.
Right. Yeah.
Like, which I think is so cool.
Yeah. Like, the black characters use the stereotypes the white characters have of them against
mm-hmm.
them rather than embodying those stereotypes themselves.
Yeah, which I think is fundamentally the question at hand when it comes to all blaxploitation, right?
Right.
And I am not going to remotely come close to trying to claim that I'm going to answer that question. I don't honestly think it is a question meant for me to answer.
Absolutely
but
not.
I do, But I do think that complexity is where the interesting dialogue exists. You know, like when I was explaining earlier to my family, like what blaxploitation was and what this movie was about and, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, there is a certain amount of reticence. Yeah, like is that okay? You know, right. Like, and I don't know if I have an answer for you, other than, I don't know. But it makes for a fucking great movie, and
right. Well, I mean, I am far from just like you. I am far from an authority on blaxploitation or indeed any other kind of exploitation cinema. And not the person you should be asking.
Right, yeah.
But, like, since I'm on here anyway and talking, like, even, like, the thing about any kind of exploitation cinema is that a lot of times, yeah, it was bad. Like, a lot of times it was perpetuating bad stereotypes, it was doing harm, but also a lot of times people were using it as an entry point to have their voices heard who might not otherwise have done so.
Right.
So it was both, like, they were, like, its intentions may have been bad, but it was often used for things that were good.
Right. Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And the big thing about horror, and I think the reason why you and I like horror as much as we do, and certainly why it has as much power in the classroom as I think it should, is the idea that it is transgressive, but it's purposely transgressive, like, not to reinforce social norms, but to, like, you know, deconstruct them,
right.
Take a look at them. And this is a wonderful example. You know, like, clearly they are trafficking in some really shitty stereotypes. But, dude, they're trafficking in those shitty stereotypes. So, as, you know, as Sugar Hill puts it, the honky can get what's coming to him. Right. You know, like,
yeah.
Fuck yeah, dude. Yeah. Like, that is where this movie becomes complex and not just another zombie film.
Yeah.
And we did talk about those zombies before. They are great and wonderful. And I think part of the reason why they recut this movie so that it's a little bit shorter and they gave it a new name so that it could kind of live again, no pun intended, on TV. And they rebranded it under the title The Zombies of Sugar Hill, which I think is even more badass. It's so good. Like,
it's
damn,
a great title.
Right?
It's a great title.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a very, like, it's definitely a very TV movie title, too. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could totally, like, see a TV yep. host, like, yeah. So, the other thing I might mention is the idea that this movie explores the complexity of what it is to be a woman, specifically, but a black woman, I think is also one of the things that Sugar Hill does not shy away from. And there is a really great article from Jeeda Wilson that comes from TSQ in 2020 called Sexploitation, Blaxploitation, and the Making of Black Womanhood. And, like, I really think if you watch this movie and watch how the white men treat her, right, mm-hmm. as a character, there's a lot of shit going on with that particular, developing those particular relationships that make the revenge that she gets so much fucking better.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and there's a lot. I mean, there is a lot, and that's one of the great things about exploitation films is that, like, on the surface, exploitation films are about, like, the most lurid thing you can possibly imagine, but they opened up a lot of channels for people to talk about stuff that is really interesting. Like, in this case, like, you know, every one of the white male characters pretty much, like, reacts to her in a little bit different way, but all of them are objectifying in their own ways.
Yeah. And gross. Yeah,
and gross.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the juxtaposition between how they treat her and how they treat the white female character, because there's basically only one white female character who has, like, a
right.
speaking lines and everything, is really, I think, you know, really telling and interesting about, like, gender politics in the 70s and, you know, still today, unfortunately.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. No, you're absolutely right, which is also, I think, part of the reason why the movie is such a standout is, like, there is no... The two dominating forces in this movie are not Baron Samedi, are not the zombies. They are Mama Matrice, and they are Sugar Hill, who are unabashedly feminine, mm-hmm. but also entirely not dependent on any male to do anything, right? Like, it's Mama Matrice that conjures Baron Samedi to begin with.
Right.
So, like she has dominion and power over him, right? And while she is a little bit, like, wary of his power and that kind of stuff, like, she gives the kind of boilerplate warning about him or whatever, like, she's got the ultimate power. She's got the ultimate kind of spiritual, philosophical power. And Sugar Hill, like, she kicks physical ass in this movie, you know?
Yes.
Like, she is the most, like, physically assertive of that group, too, which I think is just really cool to see a film dominated both from an intellectual level but also from a physical level by black women, I think is really important and really clever and you know, part of what makes the movie so
well fun. And one of the things that the scene when Baron Samedi first appears is, like, is my favorite scene in the movie and is a standout scene for me from, like, any movie. And one of the things that makes it great is that, like, Mama Matrice gives her that boilerplate warning and, like, kind of prepares her to have to fight this god on his level, you know, like you're gonna have to, you bribe him, you're gonna have to convince him. But Sugar Hill doesn't do those things. She demands his respect, and he just gives it.
Right. He's like, oh yeah.
He's like, cool. Oh, he's like, oh, okay. You know, yeah, no, you like, basically he does what she asks him to because he respects her, and she just expects him to do so.
yeah. And it is almost a different set of social rules that exist in this film, you know, like, the film, first off, and when I revisited it for this episode, like, the language is rough. It's coarse and it's rough, and it's like, it doesn't try to hide anything. So, like, it's hard. It's if you were brand new to any of this, it would be hard to get by just that, right? Yeah. But if you can get by that and see it, not as, I don't know, not as something that's reinforcing that, but something that's critiquing that, I think it can offer a way through that kind of bullshit language. Oh. And I think it is purposely using, it's not, you know, it's purposely using really terrible, I don't know, words to describe African Americans to make bad guys.
Right.
And in the 1970s, I, like, how fucking awesome is that? That, like, we don't have a guy that kicks a dog, right?
Right.
Like, we have a guy that uses the N-word in the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And I honestly don't know, and maybe it's just because I'm really down on politics as of late, I don't know if we would have the same guttural response to that now, you know? Like, we have a president who openly refers to, you know, a class of citizens as, like, murderers and rapists, and we're like, eh, it's just what he said today, you know? Like, it's like, no, that's a sign that he's a bad guy, you know?
Yeah.
The movie director is trying to say he's a bad guy, okay?
Yeah, you know? And again, one of the great things, like, in Sugar Hill is, like, is that it's more than just showing that they're a bad guy. It's like, Baron Samedi, you are prepared to be afraid of, right? Like, he is built up. But he immediately recognizes Sugar Hill as a person worthy of his respect. But the white men never do. They never see her that way, ever. And that's their downfall. Like,
Like, I just think...
Like, even Robert Quarry's character, the main villain, who obviously, like, has a kind of a gross fixation with her, still sees her as not a whole person.
Yeah. And the movie, that's his, like, that's his big flaw, right? Like, that it's not something to just accept. It's not something that socially they could grease by, you know,
right,
in the film.
It was like, a product of its time or something, right? Yeah.
Right. Like, nah, it's like, it's the reason why bad shit happens to him, you know?
Yep.
And I think, I don't know, I just think that's really spectacular.
Yeah, it's really a great film. And it's a blast. Like, it's so much fun, also, like, on top of
all oh, stuff. Yeah.
Like, it's just, it is just fucking a joy to watch.
Yeah, it truly is. I think the one thing that we haven't talked about yet that I would like to spend a little bit of time on, a lot of blaxploitation is dominated by, like, hyper-masculine, hyper-sexual male character, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of... there's a really interesting article from Screening the Past by Amanda Howell. I won't use the term she does because I'm not comfortable yeah. using it. Yeah. But I will put it in the show notes and you can take a look at it because I think it offers an interesting analysis about black masculinity. And I thought it was really interesting that Baron Samedi, essentially, you know, there are other male African-American characters, you know, including the detective, who I think is kind of interesting. But, like, mm-hmm. the only one that has specific power that we see is Baron Samedi. And my question to you, Oren, is, do you think he's, like, super masculine?
I mean, I don't think so. So, like, okay, yeah, so here's the thing that I found really interesting. Because, like, so Baron Samedi is, I mean, he's a Loa, so he's not, like, a person. But he's portrayed in the film, at least, as being, you know, straight, presumably. He has brides that show up at one point and that kind of stuff. But when I went to log that I'd watched Sugar Hill for the second time recently on on Letterboxd, I saw someone, like, I was, you know, scrolling through some other reviews, and I saw several people, like, essentially refer to him as, like, queer. They were like, he's a queer icon, they saw him as queer or gender fluid or something.
Sure.
Which I think is I think that's a legit reading of him as he's played. Like, I think I don't see him as hyper masculine, although I don't see him as not masculine either. Like, he's just a really interesting portrayal.
Yeah, I think he is coded in a specific way to run counter to that, like, hyper-masculine archetype.
Right,
okay?
Yeah.
So, what do we know about him? Number one, like, if you just look at his physicality, he's not a big dude, right? Like, he doesn't have big muscles. He's, you know, he's relatively little. I would also argue the adornments that we talked about mm-hmm. earlier are, like, very distinctly counter-masculine.
Right, you know? Well, and, like, he, like...
Especially in the 1970s.
Right, he almost exclusively wears, like, vests with mm-hmm. no shirt underneath them.
Yeah, right.
Which, and, again, to me, at least, feels like counter to what was kind of shown as masculine in the 70s. That's more of a... That would be more of, like, what you'd expect at, like, at a gay bar or something in the 70s.
Yeah, and like... I think my initial reading of him has always been that he was like the drill master, right? Like he or like the marching band, you know,
right.
Like he's got a baton and he's got this group of people, you know. And I think that kind of performance angle, right? Like mm-hmm. that kind of performance quality about him, that kind of band leader almost, or right. whatever you want to call it, codes him counter to the other way, not only in blaxploitation generally, but specifically in this movie. Like, there are other black characters, but, like, he's the one that has the power. He
right.
does all of the work, and I find it even more interesting that the one that has all of the power is the one that seems to be coded in a, you know, gender fluid or a queer fashion. I think
yeah.
that's really another reason why this movie is so badass.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, and there's so much theatricality in everything he mm-hmm. does, both, like...
Most definitely,
yeah,
yeah.
But both, like, he's always putting on an act for the other characters. Like, he's never being himself except with Sugar Hill or when they spring the trap.
Right.
He's always putting on some kind of act. He's always putting on some kind of, like, accent or mannerism that he doesn't have the rest of the time. But also, like, when he first shows up, there's, like, lightning from off-screen.
Yeah, he's
very, like, so theatrical in everything he does, which is both, you know, a delight to watch, but also kind of feeds into that coding him. Because one of the things that, like, I don't know about Blaxploitation, but, like, a lot of cinema, a lot of, like, gritty crime cinema that this would have been operating alongside, it was attempting at realism. Right, it was aiming for, like, gritty realism, and the people who you were rooting for, the heroes, they were authentic people, right? And so theatricality is counter to that as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. There is a certain amount of freedom that comes along with doing Sugar Hill as opposed to, you know, maybe a more traditional blaxploitation or something like that. Yeah. Right. Yeah, as you mentioned, he's Aloha, right? Which is the spirit of Haitian voodoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
He, at least from the research I could find, he's in charge of resurrection, which is why he's got his big entourage of zombies. And he's like the Fool character, right? Like, he's mm-hmm. always got, if you look at the iconography of Baron Samedi, he's always got a glass of rum and a cigar, so he's like this big kind of party guy,
right?
You know?
Yeah. Oh, and so it's like one of the things that I loved in the movie is the time when he's leading one of the characters into the field for one of the traps that they're setting mm-hmm. for them, and the guy turns around and it's just a cross with a top hat and a top coat over it. Like, Baron Samedi's gone, and there's just a scarecrow essentially behind him. And that's great because, like, when they would do, from the research I've done, again, not having any direct knowledge of voodoo, but what they would do was they would take a cross in a cemetery, like a gravestone, and dress it up in a top hat and a coat and everything, and that represented Baron Samedi. And so, like, that scene is a nod to that.
Yeah, the kind of history and discourse of him as a character, yeah. So, before we move on from Baron Samedi, I do want to mention a really interesting... I have a quotation here from Bell Hooks, who's a fantastic writer of, I would say, like, literary criticism. She's a sociologist. She's done a bunch of stuff. Absolutely adore her writing generally. But she argues the black body has always received attention within the framework of white supremacy as racist, sexist iconography that has been deployed to perpetrate notions of innate biological inferiority. Against this cultural backdrop, every movement for black liberation in this society, where they're... what is that?
Whether reformist?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe?
All right, let me do... Yeah. Whether reformist, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so before we leave our conversation about Baron Samedi, I have this great quotation from Bell Hooks, who's kind of a sociologist, literary critic, who I think has written really substantial stuff on black liberation. But she makes the argument, the black body has always received attention within the framework of white supremacy as racist, sexist iconography has been deployed to perpetrate notions of innate biological inferiority. Against this cultural backdrop, every movement for black liberation in this society, whether reformist or radical, has had to formulate a counter-hegemonic discourse of the body to effectively resist white supremacy. And, you know, her argument is essentially that, you know, African-American men and women need to reclaim their own body before they ever seek to reclaim areas like film and that kind of stuff. And, like, I think that is what is most respected from my angle about this movie, is both Sugar Hill and Baron Samedi do that. You know, they not only have dominion over their own bodies, but those zombies are also black bodies, and they, you know, have dominion over them too. And I think that maybe like alludes to some historical angles that we don't even get into in this movie that are just so important and fascinating.
Well, and
you know?
Another thing that's interesting, so, like, the zombies we see in the movie are all former slaves. Like, they have they have manacles and everything, and they say that they were slaves. But, like, when Baron Samedi is introducing them and introducing his power and giving his speech to Sugar Hill when he shows up, he says that they were... that he has power over all the ones who were dead, slave and master alike.
Yeah. Right, which only alludes to the fact that, like... yeah, you know, maybe on some religious angle that, you know, like, we're all the same when we're dead. But also... exerts a power and control over white bodies, which I think is, you know, probably problematic because it feeds into that. The bad parts of blaxploitation, right?
Right.
But
at the same I think it's a small throwaway that is significant in like showing the power dynamic of this film, that all the power rests with. All the power actually rests with these characters rather than the people who think they have it. Like, essentially, the white supremacy is an illusion that the white people use to think they have power over people they don't have power over.
Yeah. And not only that, right? Because that message within itself, but painted in a white supremacist, like, pattern, right? Like, using that backdrop... could be really scary and can like trigger that kind of like white fear that some blaxploitation uses.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But like, but this movie is not doing that.
No.
Not at all. Right. No. Like it is not unabashedly trying to do any of that work for white supremacy. It's like, nah, man, like you people are awful. Right. And here are the righteous ones. And
right.
I think the idea of righteousness in this film is really important to painting a positive dynamic of blaxploitation, I think.
Absolutely. I would agree. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you somebody who doesn't agree. Have you taken a look at what our anonymous Amazon user has to say today?
I think I skimmed it. I don't know if I've read the whole thing, so...
You want me to take this one, or you want to read it?
I can do it. I can do it. It'll probably something I didn't catch will jump out at me and hurt me as I'm reading. It'll be good.
Awesome.
So yes, our anonymous Amazon user begins their review by establishing their bona fides here by saying that lava lamps and platform shoes are cool, but this movie is just a turd from the 1970s someone dusted off and remastered for the zombie generation. Sure. There's nothing even remotely funny about any of this, except maybe the stock footage they used for the nature scenes.
It is bad.
Yeah, well, that's the 70s for you. The acting is beyond terrible. Super, don't agree. You can look at the movie cover, and that's about as much as you'll get from the rest of it. Several reviews rave about the leading lady's beauty. Well, I wouldn't throw rocks at her or anything, but that purple jumpsuit isn't her best look. What? Oh my god.
So good.
No idea how this got a decent rating. I'd post zero if they'd let me. The fact that this movie was released in the new millennium is an embarrassment to the human race.
I mean, that's just so adamant.
That last one's a real, like, that last line, it really takes a turn there. Like, it's like...
Yeah, like...
Going from, this movie is bad, to this movie is an embarrassment to the entire human race.
Yeah, right. Like, even no matter what subgenre you want to put it in, blaxploitation, zombie, you know, whatever, like, there are so many, and this is the kind of, I have sat through this year, right, as the editor here at Signal Horizon, I have watched movies about killer sofas and killer bedroom sets, you know, like, dude, you need to watch more horror movies, because there's a lot of terrible shit out there, man.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And this ain't it.
This ain't it.
Also, keep talking shit on Miss Sugar Hill and you might get hit, because
no kidding.
I'm telling you, Marky Bay is smoking hot, and anybody in a purple jumpsuit, pretty much anybody in a purple jumpsuit, I think looks pretty goddamn good. So.
Also, like, I don't know, I appreciate you for always picking out, like, the anonymous Amazon reviews that are like, I'm going to invalidate any authority I might possibly have had by, like, just being a freaking misogynist or something in Like, I'm gonna spend like half my review objectifying this woman. That's
right.
I'm just gonna go ahead and, this movie that's about a strong woman, I'm just gonna go ahead and talk about her looks the entire time, and that's it.
Well, and maybe this is a colloquialism I just don't get, but like I've heard I wouldn't kick her out of bed, which makes sense to me. Like I understand that, right? But I wouldn't throw rocks at her. Like, what the fuck does that even mean? Yeah. Like I wouldn't stone her to death, but you know, what?
But ugly women, I would throw rocks. Right, at them. Like right, what? No, right. What the hell?
Yeah, right.
What
like,
the hell is wrong with you, anonymous Amazon user?
Her face is less than symmetrical, so I guess she gets the stoning today. Yeah. Yeah. Jesus. Yeah, man. Thankfully, most of our listeners here are the good students, so they can avoid all of this.
Oh, my God.
Listen, man. Sugar Hill is a complicated, fantastic movie. Thanks for picking it, dude, because it was totally fun to kind of dive deep into
it. Yeah, I love this movie. And the funny thing is, I had never seen it. Until the guys at Rough Cut, which make my favorite movie shirts, put out a shirt of it, and I was like, "Well, hey, that looks cool. I should check that out." And that's how I saw it first. And it's my favorite shirt of theirs. I wear it all the time. So,
well, cool. We'll have a link to that. Maybe they're still selling those Sugar Hill T-shirts. That'd be pretty cool if they were.
They're great shirts.
Yeah, great tie-in. The one thing that we did not mention, if you have not seen Sugar Hill and you want to check it out, it is free with ads on Tubi TV.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah, like, you don't need to buy it. Take a look at what they're doing there on Tubi. It's pretty great generally anyways. So I think anything left to be said about, the zombies of Sugar Hill?
Nothing besides that they are great. Everyone should go watch them.
Yeah, they really are. Check this movie out and then tell us what you think. Oren, where can they find more of your stuff?
As always, I am Oren Gray on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as at orengray.com.
Very good. You can find me shouting into the void that is Twitter, at Ty Unsel. Otherwise, go to www.signalhorizon.com and check out what we're doing. We are trying to publish some new folks, so if you have some intellectual horror takes that you want to find an audience, I will pay you to write that stuff for me. Just hit me up at tyler@signalhorizon.com. Send me your pitches. I want you to be a part of our team. I want to hear what you have to say. Otherwise, you can check out Signal Horizon at Facebook and Twitter. That's where we post all of our new stuff. Next week, we have a fantastic, I think, friend of yours, right, Oren?
Oh, yeah.
Jimma Files, who is another award-winning writer who, like, kind of has crafted this, like, wonderful niche of, like, scary movie literature, like haunted TV episode.
Yeah.
Like, she's an author that has just learned to craft that, like, episode of Full House that really is a demonic possession episode, you know, or whatever, like, better than anyone else I've seen. Gemma's work is fan-fucking-tastic. So.
Yeah, it's amazing. And
She's also, like, an expert when it comes to Aboriginal horror. So next week, we're going to have Jimma Files on, and we're going to be talking about the 2020 Shudder release, Blood Quantum. Check that out. The movie's fantastic. So, until then, class dismissed. I said a hip hop, the hip, the hip, to the hip, hip hop. You don't stop the rocket to the bang, bang, boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Now, what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, the purple, and yellow. But first,